Hello and welcome to the For the Win podcast. I'm Ted Berg, joined on the line today by my friend and a man to whom really I owe my baseball writing career, Mr. Matt Cerrone. Matt, how are you? Right? It's true.
I wouldn't go that far, but wow, that makes me feel nice, Ted, because you're awesome and I love your work.
Well, I wouldn't say you're the only person, right? But you were a big factor in me having a job right now.
I'm going to say this right up front. Like you're so good at what you do. You would have found your way. So like, thanks, but you'd have been fine.
I don't know that's true. But if you want, we can just sit around and talk about how dope I am. I would be totally cool with that.
We've never done that before. Nah.
No. But you have a book. You wrote a book. This is exciting.
It is. You know, it's interesting. It's funny. Well, first off, it's a Mets book. It's called New York Mets Fans Bucket List. You can find it at MatthewCerrone.com/Mets book, and that'll take you to Amazon and all these places you can get it. But it's funny.
Full five stars on Amazon, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I know it's not just on me. I didn't review it.
I know. Well, you should.
Well, I'm still waiting on my copy, sir.
I know. It is in the mail. I mailed a whole bunch of them out. It was very weird. Well, that's two funny little anecdotes. So, like, first off, when they sent me the book, it was, like, out of the blue. I didn't know. I got, like, three cardboard boxes, you know, taped up. They just showed up, and, like, I opened it up, and sure enough, it's the book. And the first thing I thought of was Back to the Future. Like, I don't know if you remember that scene where, like, the father, he writes, he's, like, finally becomes an author, and, like, it's mm-hmm. the exact same, you know, moment. And, like, that was the first thing I thought of. It was, like, this great career moment, and all I could think about is Back to the Future 3. The other thing is I'm driving to a book signing the other night, which was incredibly awkward and really weird. But it dawned on me that, like, oh, I could probably see the book on a shelf. Like, that hadn't even honestly even occurred to me because we deal in so much digital stuff that, like, I didn't really think about, oh, this is on a bookshelf. And, like, I could see it. And, like, I remember 15 years ago walking around Arlington, like, trying to find myself as a writer, going through bookstores and, like, looking, you know, at titles and, oh, it'd be nice to write a book. You know, you'd think this moment would have been poignant and not wasted on me. And I completely forgot about it because, like, it's such a digital experience. And we think Amazon and links and all this stuff that, like, hard copy in a store actually is still kind of cool. And that was really neat. So, like, when I got to see that, that was actually kind of awesome, too.
Yeah, I've gotten to I had that experience with Alex Belth, who's another friend of ours, made a book about Yankee Stadium back in the day, and I wrote an essay for that. And so that was my first experience with that, was like going to Barnes & Noble and being like, I'm actually in this book. This is incredible. And now I have this experience of this bar I hang out at has a bunch of books in the back. One of them is they always keep the Baseball Prospectus Annual, and I wrote the Mets essay for the Baseball Prospectus Annual this year. And so I always want to autograph it, and like I don't know if that's presumptuous to be like, can I just sign this book, because no one's asked me to sign a book yet and I would really like to sign a book, and I'm in this book that you have at this bar, but I haven't crossed that bridge yet.
That could be on your bucket list.
So let's talk about this concept. First of all, is it good?
I think it's good. But I'll tell you what's funny is, like, I wrote it and then off it went, right? And then, like, 2 months later, I get in the mail in, like, a, you know, an envelope, the whole book essentially printed on just, you know, printer paper, and I apparently have to read it and edit it. And I had no idea. I was like, oh, I didn't know I had to read the book. I thought I just had to write it. Like, I can't remember the last time I read, like, a whole book cover to cover. So, like, I actually did have to read it, and it was, it is good. It's
God, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, I was like, damn, I didn't, okay, fine, but shoot, when do you need this by? Yeah, and I think it's pretty easy. It's an easy read. What I like is, like, diehard fans seem to really enjoy it, but then also their spouse or, you know, other Yankee fans. I've heard from a lot of Yankee fans that have read it that really like it. And I think it's because it sort of gives a little window into our crazy. It's not, you know, it's not a book about on-field stuff. Like, yeah, there's a couple, you know, obviously little moments that make up the experience of being a Mets fan from going to games, obviously, but so much of it is this, you know, everything else that happens really off-field, from the silly to, you know, the poignant to the miracles and all these different things. And, like, it's really – it focuses on all those experiences. And I think these other fans and these other people really enjoy it because it's like, oh, okay, this is what they're talking about, or this is why they care about that. It's almost like a little window into – like I said, the craziness of being a Mets fan.
Yeah, you start out with LOL Mets, like LOL Mets, right? Which is sort of a really good place to start, I think, for Mets fans.
You know, I just sent them all the essays, so I wasn't really sure how they were going to set it up. And I'm thrilled. And I was really happy to see that, because that really is such an important component. Like, that really shapes our, and I say our because you're a Mets fan. I'm a Mets fan, and like that's
our. I try not to be a public Mets fan nowadays. I mean, but yeah, I watch the Mets a lot. I'll say
but
that.
But you are.
You can say so it.
It's and you know, all those little things, all of those moments, the Bonilla stuff and the firecrackers in the locker room and the Midnight Massacre and Ruben getting yelled at by, you know, or accused of by Omar Minaya, and like all those little things, all those things really make up so much of our anxiety and fear and panic and you know, hesitant, you know, way that we kind of get our hopes up and all this stuff. And so, like, I was really happy that they led with that, because there's a lot of other really joyful, fun, you know, experiences that come throughout the book. But to start there, I thought was actually kind of funny and perfect.
Yeah, and it's fun for me, like, just be on a personal level, because not only for a lot of these things, and I've, you know, just looking at that first chapter, for a lot of the later things, I had a very up-close seat for a lot of it, because working at SNY, and also, you know, sitting next to you for the whole time, it was like, oh yeah, like, I do remember that this is what Cerrone thought about this when it happened, you know, and so it's a fun jaunt down memory lane, like you mentioned Willie Randolph getting fired at 3:12 a.m., if you'll remember. I was the person who first published that story online. I was the guy who woke up at 3 a.m. to tell the world that Willie Randolph had been fired.
The other one that I did not put in the book, and I'll just mention it briefly here, is the story of the Johan Santana signing and the contract and me in the car and you at the desk. And I didn't mention that one because I wasn't really sure if that was okay. But like it, there was a lot of little things that went on over those that time when we were at SNY together that was actually kind of fun. And
yeah, I think I can tell that story. I mean, I don't know if you can, but yeah. So when the Mets traded for Johan Santana, it was contingent on them signing him to a contract extension. It was literally my second day working at SNY, I think, or something like that. It was like, you know, very, very early. I barely knew you. I barely knew the rules of I had no journalism background. I had worked as a editor, but basically like a web producer at MLB.com, and I got hired at SNY. Didn't really know how reporting worked at all at that stage, and it was I would say like surprisingly analog. You were leaving, you had to go, and it was like that we found out that they were doing the negotiations in our offices, in the SNY offices, and you were like, dude, just go camp out outside.
Well, the entire company was essentially at the basketball tournament that they do. So you were like there holding down the fort, essentially.
Right. And so it was like, so I figured out which conference room they were in, and I set up at the receptionist's desk outside, sort of posing as a receptionist. and like, I remember they got food delivered, and I texted you, like, they just got Chinese food. And then you put it on the blog, and like, there were people in the room like, how do they know we got Chinese food? It was me sitting there like telling you all of these things. And then it was like a layup. The guy, like, after like I had sat there for 2 hours just like pretending I just worked there and wasn't telling people what was happening, someone came out on the phone and was just like, yeah, dude, it's 136.5, like the exact terms of the deal. I was like, pretty sure it's 7 years and 136.5.
I don't know, man. That's great. Yeah, probably, I think those are the terms. I think that, well, yeah, that sounds about right.
I don't think nowadays I couldn't report like that. Like that was because I didn't know what I was doing, right? Like now I would have the confidence to ask the guy, be like, hey, did you just say those are the terms of the deal then? And it would be like, a person close to Santana confirmed this, right? But at that point, it was just like, this is what I heard, and that was the case.
I can vaguely remember trying to bait you into, like, when they brought the food in, I said, well, why don't you sign for and you bring the food in?
Right.
Like, go in there with it.
Yeah, what are you guys eating? What is Johan eating? Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, those are good. Those are good times. There was a lot of those things that we sort of sat front row for and got to look behind backstage a little bit. And I integrate a little bit of those things into the book here and there. Like, there's, you know, a moment of getting to talk to Bill Buckner. I know you talked, you got a little chit chat with them as well. And like, you know, I kind of pulled that into the, you know, moment of the ground ball and 86 and all mm-hmm. that. And so I try to pull in little stuff. because ultimately the book isn't about me necessarily. It's but I wanted to sort of fill in a little bit and tell some stories just from my own experiences. And I think that's partly why they asked me to write the book. It's a series that Triumph put out for all teams and all sports, and it's mostly beat writers. And I think they were reluctant at first. I think they wanted a Mets beat writer. My literary agent kind of sold them on this idea that, well, I cover the team, but I'm also a fan. And
I think it works much better coming from you.
I like it. And I think once they kind of got into it and they saw the table of contents and saw where I was going, they got really excited for it. And we're like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Like, it's a different experience. Mets fans are kind of different in that way. So, like, maybe this brings a different flavor to the book. And I think it does.
And I mean, there's not really a lot of people in this world who get to be professional baseball fans, right? So we are extremely lucky in that way. And so, like, there's not a lot of context, I think, from a publishing standpoint for, like, what can this guy do for us? But this is a really good example of, like, something, a perspective that really, like, you can offer and not a lot of other people can.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, and you're in that boat, and there's a lot of us now, it seems, but, like, it is kind of interesting because, like, you're just writing, right? Like, I'm just writing my experience. It just happens to include all of these kind of unique, cool things that most people don't get to do, but it's nevertheless just, like, we're just doing it. It's not like it's part of an agenda or anything. Like, we're just fans who are in this situation and I'm writing about it. Like, it's pretty basic. And I think that comes through in the text too. Like, it's not really like the book in general. I'm not a big historical guy. Like, I like the story of the season. I talk a lot about how I feel and the narrative of the season and blah, blah, blah and stuff. And, you know, so, like, it's this for me, I didn't want to go too crazy with it. Like, I'll leave that to the, if you're a Mets fan, you know, I'll leave that to the Greg Princes of the world to really dig in and kind of get into the skeleton of the history. For me, this is more just like these 800,000 word essays that are really short, kind of quick hit on what the experience is like, what you get out of it, you know, maybe what I got out of it, and you move on. And it's pretty quick. It moves fast. And that's the other thing too. Like, I've been pitched books over the years and I don't know, it just never really, stuck with me. But this one felt like blogging. Like, it was essentially what I do, but not news and rumor. Like, finally get a chance to not have to go over, you know, the 25th man on the roster and, like, why they didn't hit and run and what the trade rumor is. Like, this was an opportunity to
talk about. Why did they use Salas again? Yeah.
Right, you know, but this is to talk about the Get Mesmerized song and, you know, a lot of just random stuff that I would never get to write about and have an opportunity to because it just doesn't fit in with, you know,
well,
the
because if the Mets lose, if the Mets lost a game and then you wrote about a song from 1986 the next day, you'd be lynched by Mets fans, basically.
Of course. But, like, that's a really ridiculous song. And, like, if you're a Mets fan, you don't know about it, you should. And if you haven't heard it in a while, you should go back and listen to it because it is the best worst thing you'll ever hear.
Is there anything on the bucket list here that you haven't done yourself?
Oh, yeah, there's a whole bunch of things. I haven't actually gone through and, like, checked stuff out. I mean, fantasy camp, you know? I was supposed to go and do that. I was training for it and then got pneumonia, which you're going to laugh at because that's typical of me. And then I couldn't go down. So I didn't get down there. So, like, yeah.
I remember because I went in your stead. I didn't get to participate in fantasy camp, but I went and spoke to Wally Backman, basically.
That was fun.
Talking to Wally Backman should be like item number one on a Mets fan's bucket list.
It's so funny. You know, I didn't, well, yeah, that would have been a short essay because the reason for that, can't really get too into it, right? But, like, right. You're right about that.
I will say that Wally will make you feel you could have never seen a baseball game before in your life. And if you sit down and have a conversation with him, he will make you feel like you have been in baseball as long as he has. It's kind of an amazing thing. He's an extremely, for all the everything else that comes along with it, sort of an extremely charismatic and engaging guy. And you understand why you hear these stories of, you know, players loving him so much and certain fans loving him so much when you actually do talk to him, because he is a really interesting dude to talk to.
No, that's an excellent point, right? So, like, 100%. When you talk to him, you realize why players love him, and you also realize why people in suits maybe don't.
Right.
You know, like, it's why he's had such a hard time, or, like, explains his history in the game. It's like, yeah, I mean,
want to be telling me this right now? Like, are you sure you want to be talking about this? I remind you that the camera is rolling.
Yeah. And we just met.
Right. Yeah. We just met. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. So, Yeah, Fantasy Camp is probably the one that jumps out. There's a couple other things. I mean, there's a lot of things on there that, because I asked too. It's social media, right? So I put out like, what are some things that people should know or places people should go? And a lot of people sent back stuff I had never heard of or never done. I kind of knew of it, didn't know a ton about it. And so I got an opportunity to research a little bit and write about some things that I wasn't so familiar with. And so that was kind of cool too. And then also just circle back, I hate to use that term, I'm talking to you so it comes out, circle back on things like Tom Seaver and how he, got drafted and then signed with, a contract with another team and then the lottery and all these things and the way he kind of came to the Mets. I kind of knew that and probably heard that story, but haven't really had a chance to or need to discuss or even think about it. And so to go back in and kind of go through all that was kind of cool too.
Right. And it's one of these things where it's like, well, I heard it when I was 10 years old and it didn't seem that weird that there was this lottery where three teams right. picked and the Mets happened to get the pick for Tom Seaver. Then you think about it in today's context and you're like, well, that doesn't really happen very often. Yeah.
Right. When I try, and the other thing too is, and I think you'll appreciate this as a Mets fan, is like I tried to take those little things and sort of connect them to why we're fans. So like, that moment was really lucky. It was a miracle in some ways that it shook out the way it did. And, that miracle and that sort of luck feeling and stuff is really part of Mets DNA that you got to believe and the ground ball through the, legs and all these things. And so like I tried to kind of keep this constant thread too of like, yeah, these things are all random in a way, but like there is some commonality. Like the comedians, by and large, comedians are Mets fans. There are some. The Cubs are a close a distant second, but it's really Mets.
But that makes sense too. That makes sense too.
Sure.
Right? Like those would be the teams that comedians like.
Of course, and with the Mets, and talking with the comedians, like there's the reason they like them, or a lot of reasons why a lot of Mets fans like them. It's not, so there's these commonalities between all these experiences, and I tried to capture that, even though that's not the purpose of the book. I tried to kind of capture that a little bit because, I think it's important.
I feel like so much of the Mets mystique is sort of wrapped up in the fact that they will, unfortunately, or for better or worse, they will always be the second team in New York, right? There's the other team in New York is the one that wins the World Series every other year and the one that has the history and that had Babe Ruth and that had Mickey Mantle and that has this storied past. And so the Mets are always sort of the ugly duckling younger mm-hmm. brother, mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes them appealing to the masses to some extent. And it's what adds like a comic, yes. sort of comic element to it. And I think that's why, you can't be Chris Rock and be a Yankees fan, right? Like it just wouldn't work.
No, exactly. It's that it's contrarian. It's the road less traveled. It's sort of the other team, there's this vibe that kind of, I think a lot of us, at least Mets fans, I know, they're not the most, it's not the professional buttoned up, that's the Yankees and that's what they put out, And so I think if you're, if you're going to be a little more rogue, you're going to be a little bit more like you're going to go into stand-up comedy, for instance, like you're probably going to be more attracted to, I think, the Mets sensibilities, which, by the way, and this is what I was saying before, are kind of sprinkled throughout a lot of the things that go on, throughout the experience of being a Mets fan.
I mean, you're never going to get – the Yankees don't have a mascot. Even if they did,
no.
You'd never see the Yankees mascot flipping a fan the bird. It's just not going to happen.
No, of course not, because it's, it's not instilled in their values or whatever.
That had to be Mr. Met. That had to be
yeah.
Mr. Met.
Oh, yeah. only way. It's funny, too, because, I don't know if that would have been in the LOL Mets chapter or essay, but it might have been. And, you got to love it. I publish it, and within, not very long – this season alone, a variety of things already have occurred that could have been in that chapter. They couldn't even let the book be fresh off the press
right.
before
yeah, you
doing things that could have been in the book.
Your book was obsolete the day it was published. I'm sorry to tell you. But I target a general audience, especially on the podcast, but in baseball writing now. And there's a lot here, I think, that probably applies to most baseball fans. Are there experiences here or elsewhere or that you've had that you would say should go on every baseball fan's bucket list?
Well, yeah, one we shared, which was going to Wrigley, mm-hmm. I think is, without question, something you got to do. I mean, it's, I would have said that about the old Yankee Stadium, this current one, not so much. Fenway, obviously, but Wrigley, it's just such a anomaly at this point, and it has a feel to it. When you're there, you feel like you're in old-time baseball. It's just an awesome thing. And Cubs fans are just completely sort of different in the way they go about it. They're so much more concerned or interested in being Cubs fans than they are with the Cubs sometimes that mm-hmm. it takes on this whole other feel like for Mets fans, we're very much the opposite. Like, we're very much into, you know, the seven line aside and what those guys do. Like, we're very much into what happens on field and sort of the experience of being a Mets fan. Sometimes we're a little embarrassed of it. It's a little weird. And Cubs fans, it's they, you know, up until recently, like, it was rah-rah Cubs. Even if they're losing, they sing that song and it's a Cubs experience. And, like, that's what they're going to go to Wrigley and do this thing. And, like, the game almost seems like it was secondary. And, like, that's just a kind of a cool thing to go and experience. So I write about that in the book, but, like, I think any fan would, you know, should do that. And I think probably fantasy camp. Like, it's pretty crazy. Like, it's taken on this, you know, I think it used to be more of a baseball thing. And, like, now it really is more about going and just reconnecting with your childhood and meeting some people and, you know, making some bonds with guys that you're playing ball with. But then also, you know, getting to face Doc Gooden, who clearly is not the Doc Gooden he was, but it's still kind of cool for you. And, you know, every fan base, every team does that now. Like, it started with the Cubs way back when, and, you know, now everybody does it, and they're done in such a way that, like, it's expensive. And if you, you know, obviously it costs a lot to do it, but if you can, like, it sounds, anybody that I've talked to that goes, like, it's an amazing experience.
Yeah, just to the Wrigley thing, and you know, I am now afforded access that is, fortunately for me, you know, goes well beyond the typical fan. And I try to, you know, as much as I get stressed out, as much as I have a job and work to do, and I work hard, you know, I do try to keep in perspective the things I get to do. Being on the field at Wrigley when the Cubs clinched the NLCS to go to the World Series in last season was like, it's coming in the middle of a postseason, you know, after I'd already been to DC and Toronto and Cleveland, yep, and then to LA and then back to Cleveland and then to, like, just all over the place, totally stressed out, hadn't slept in my bed in a month, hadn't slept in the same bed for more than three nights in a month, you know, just like completely, just, you know, completely, yeah, shot, completely shot by that point. And then you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm on the field at Wrigley Field. The Cubs are all celebrating. The people are all singing in, and it's like, wait, I'm gonna go check out the Ivy. Like, I can go walk out there and check out the Ivy. And it's like I was honestly like just like as a baseball fan, just like tearing up a little bit. Like, this is so impossible that I get to experience these things. You know, that, like, when I was 9 years old, I never could have imagined that I get to do this stuff. And now it becomes like, oh no, now I gotta go to Wrigley Field for that. It's like, oh no.
You can have it both ways. You know, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think the other one is spring training. Like, we've been down there a bunch of times, mm-hmm, together, and then just kind of cross paths while we've been down there. Like, if you're a family and you got, especially if you have kids, like, it's
nothing like
it's it. Yeah, because it's not, you know, it's baseball, but it's not consequential baseball. It's not winning and losing isn't the, you know, the cover to it all and the end all be all of what's happening that day. And it, you know, I think there's some people that get to go to baseball games. They'll go to Citi Field or Wrigley or whatever. And they'll, like we were just saying about Cubs fans, and they'll enjoy the experience and have a good time, win or lose. But for the most part, I think most baseball fans, you know, it is about the winning and the losing. And that does sort of color the day. There is none of that. When you go for workouts or you're down there for pitchers and catchers, like, there's no games. So it's just skill. It's nice weather. They make the players very accessible. You know, it's just a completely different experience, but yet it's still within a baseball context, and you still get to see these guys doing what, you know, and we've talked about this when we're down there. Like, it's so easy to forget, but there are, you know, so few people on the planet that can do what they're doing at the level that they're doing, mm-hmm, even the worst player, you know? And so, like, to watch the skill and just the artistry of what they're doing is just really cool too. And if you're a true baseball fan, and again, if you have kids, like, that's something you got to do. And so I write about that in the book, but that definitely applies to any baseball fan.
Yeah, I always say that. It's the and I always think about it, like, especially when you get to, like, if you're from the Northeast or from any sort of anywhere in the northern half of the country, you get to February and you've been holed up in your home for the entire winter. To go out, not only just to see the grass, just to see, like, the spread out wide open spaces and the lovely weather is great, but then spring training offers you access to the players doing baseball skills in a proximity you just will never, ever, ever get during the regular season. You can walk up right behind the cage and watch Giancarlo Stanton take batting practice. And it is every bit as glorious as you could possibly imagine, you know, and you could just do that. That's spring training. Like, and then you hear what he has to say after you, like, he was like, oh, I got that one, or I didn't, you know, oh, like that one was off. You know, like you hear them react, you hear them, you see them as people in a way you really never do from TV or even from going to games.
Well, even more non-glamorous, but incredibly unique, maybe never happened ever again. I don't know if I told you this story. Actually, this was this year. I was in line at Walmart, and Jim Leland was in front of me.
Right. Like, that happens. Yeah, that happens. And I love that. There's another thing I love about spring training is, and now I've had the experience of going to, at this point, pretty much most teams' spring training camps. And every team's spring training camp has the closest Starbucks. And before practice starts, there is always several baseball players in street clothes in the Starbucks and several fans in that team garb standing in front of Justin Verlander on line with no idea that Justin Verlander is standing right behind them on line, and it's amazing to watch because we get to see
it is.
I think when you get to see baseball players in street clothes, you start looking for that, and you see like there are indications like this guy's wearing designer shirt jeans and like this particular type of shirt, and he's got this type of build, and you can identify, like, I can see if I go into a Chipotle in a minor league town, I can pick out the minor leaguers, you know, but I think that if you're not used to that, and that was like an adjustment for me at one point too, if you're not used to seeing these guys in street clothes without their hats on, without their uniforms, you're not really looking for them. And so it's funny to see how often people just miss like the biggest stars on their teams who, when they're standing right behind them, and it's a very entertaining thing for me.
Agreed.
What else? What you wrote about Cooperstown a little bit.
Yeah. I wiggled in there too at the end that I may have given up the longest home run of all time on that field. I played when I was in Babe Ruth League, some kind of national all-star tournament when I could still walk and pitch without hyperventilating. And they, it was just an absolute bomb that went over the house that's out in that field. So I kind of wiggled like that story in. But yeah, I mean, overall, Cooperstown, I mean, again, same thing. It's just, you know, the type of thing that even if you're not like a big historical buff and all that, so the pomp and circumstance of being up there and just the breadth of baseball that goes on, you can't, you know, help but be in awe of it. Like it's something that for me, at least, I always remember being intoxicating. Like, you just like, wow, there's a tradition up here, and these people are so passionate about this, and like there's a seriousness but yet a respect and a joy that goes with it all, and like it really taps into I think kind of what started you as a fan and all this. And then obviously the museum, and if you're for us, for Mets fans, you know, you get to go see the Piazza stuff and Seaver and go through all those things, but just as a general tone, you know, of the city and the town, it just has this feel to it that you can't escape. I think just that in and of itself, to be part of that current and that tide, is actually kind of cool and a fun thing to be part of.
Yeah, I always get bogged down in, like, because the Hall of Fame debate is such a big annual and such a contentious thing every year. And, you know, I personally believe rather strongly that Barry Bonds should be in the Hall of Fame, and that honestly, like, the Hall of Fame is sort of trivialized if they're not putting the best players in baseball history in there. And so, you know, I get sort of cynical about it. And then I wind up in Cooperstown, and you're like, oh, no, this is amazing. Like, it's a mecca to baseball. You know, it's more than the museum. It's this whole, like, this whole town, this whole idyllic little country town just built on baseball.
Yeah, it's like this is crazy, but it's like a physical manifestation of like how we think about the game. Like, it just, and you feel it when you're there, and you're right. Because I don't particularly care for the Hall of Fame in terms of the people in it. Like, I think it's overrated. It's essentially become like a hall of better than average, mostly good players. Like, I don't know that I agree with a lot of people in it, and you're right. Like, I could very easily get pulled into one of those debates, but I kind of keep myself out of it because it's like, what do I care? It's not going to, whether Piazza got in the Hall of Fame or not, it's not going to change the fact that I still love watching Mike Piazza play baseball. And
right.
Like,
and you still my, have that. You
yeah.
Still
and
have
that's not
with,
going
yeah.
anywhere. And I'm sure there are, you know, people, the favorite players of mine that got into the Hall. I can't tell you what year they got in or how many home runs they had, whatever. But I know that I loved watching Ricky Henderson or Ozzie Smith. Like, you know, it doesn't matter to me. So like, I kind of keep my distance that way. But again, even with that, when you go up there, you can't help but feel, like I said, in awe of of the hall. It's a pretty interesting experience.
I want to talk about the current Mets a little bit, but I'm looking at the table of contents from your book right now, and I'm seeing that chapter 5, page 183, things to read. It says this is on the Mets fans bucket list.
I know.
It says click on MetsBlog.com.
Got it. It's so funny. I just got this question at a book signing. I said it felt so self-serving and terrible to me, but like, it started, and it's funny, it started as an essay on Mets blogs. Like, it was going to, I wasn't really going to make Mets blog the focus. Like, it was going to be sort of like about the online Mets blogging, you know, community and sort of how it got started and led to Mets Twitter. But there's really not that many sites left. And so, like, there was nothing else left to write about. And so I just figured, all right, well, you know what? I'm going to use it as an opportunity just to sort of tell the story of Mets blog.
People are welcome to dive through the TED Quarters archive too. I could say that should be a bucket list item.
Oh man, I'm not gonna lie. Like, it's not wasted on me. I get it. It felt really kind of weird when I did it. But I was like, well, you know what? Whatever. I promote things all the time. Like, it's not the end of the world.
No,
So
I'm just busting your chops. All right. This Mets team. 2017. It's in late June. Matt, the Mets are bad.
Well, they're injured, right? And they're bad.
They're bad.
The guys that are left are bad.
Guys that are healthy are underperforming, right? Like, DeGrom has been okay, and he's the best of the starting pitching. Harvey, before he was hurt, was bad. It's bad. I thought they were going to be good. I picked them to win the NL East. I feel like a stooge because if you look at the rest of my predictions, they're so good, and I'm so proud of them. I actually picked the Rockies to make the playoffs. I'm like the only dude who did that, and I want to be able to like hype up my own stuff and be like, look at how good I was, except that right there, that glaring mistake is that I picked the Mets to win the NL East, and the Mets are not good.
Well, you couldn't predict that they were going to put 14 of their 25 opening day guys on the disabled list,
no,
right?
No,
right.
Well, you kind of can. You kind of can.
I know, you kind of could. That's a good point. Well, you could have prepared for it. That is really the criticism. Like, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, so I know we've had this argument ad nauseum, but there is the, you know, the mental, psychological, you know, the element of the game and everything that goes into it. And yeah, Jake DeGrom is who he is, but like when you're left to sort of carry the load and you know Matt Harvey isn't having it and Syndergaard's on the DL and what goes through DeGrom's head when he takes the mound that day and maybe his shoulder feels a little, and in the past maybe he could have gotten through that, but now he's putting extra pressure and oh, by the way, someone's playing shortstop that shouldn't even be on the team.
Right.
And I got to, you know, all these things factor in and now all of a sudden Jake DeGrom has a 3.9 ERA and he's not as good. And it's not that he's not as good. It's just, my God, how could you be good?
Right. No, I want to make it clear that of all the people to blame for the Mets season, I would say DeGrom is probably one of the very few you could say like not Jacob DeGrom's fault, like not Jay Bruce's fault, not Michael Conforto's fault. And that's about it.
But you can make the same argument about other guys on the team that are being put in other positions. Right. I mean, I don't think you ever want to be in a position where Jose Reyes is expected to do what Jose Reyes has been expected to do. I mean, it's just not, you know, if he was that valuable, he would have, you know, teams would have been falling all over themselves to try to get him last
right.
year.
Right, he's not an everyday player at this point.
You know, and so they're in an odd spot. I mean, I love TJ Rivera, who's a, you know, an extra player. He's a nice hitter, and I think he's a good player to have on a team. But he's not your everyday third baseman, second baseman, third baseman, first baseman, moving him around. Like, that's just a lot to ask of these guys. And I think they're in that position because of all the injuries. And it's not like they just lost a couple fringe players. Like, they lost their ace, their closer, who saved 51 games last year, Cespedes for a while, their shortstop, their catcher. Like, I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about
literally every guy on the team has been hurt. So outside of Conforto and the whole outfield, basically, except Cespedes, everybody has been hurt at some point.
Were you writing with us in 2009? I can't remember. Did you leave there?
Oh, no. I was just talking about this with one of my coworkers, Charles Curtis, actually. We were trying to come up with – he had a question for you, which was, where does this season rank among the most miserable? And I said, no, it's 2009.
Yeah, it is 2009 because at least while there are more injuries this year and like last Friday was I've never had to do anything like that. We made 9 posts about injuries within a 2-hour span. And it was ridiculous. You know, at least they still have some good players, and there's a, you know,
and there's excitement, right? Like, now Max is back. You get to watch Steven Max pitch, and you're like, oh, it's exciting about the future.
2009 was there was no question it was going down. Like, there was no debate, you know, 100%. So, like, that made it, that gave it a different feel. Like, we were writing about the Titanic, not, you know, a stalled car on the side of the road. Like, this is a stalled car. That was the Titanic.
Well, there was one classic, there were several classic moments that year. I know that some of them made the Lowell Mets section. That was the year of the Tony Bernazard shirtless fighting minor leaguers incident and subsequent press conference with Omar Minaya calling out Adam Rubin. And I remember that well because that also coincided with my honeymoon. And I was on a JetBlue flight back from Costa Rica, and I, you know, really enjoying a week and a half away from the Mets nonsense at that point. And right as we came back into the service area for DirecTV on the JetBlue flight, the first thing I saw was ESPN, an ESPN clip, and I didn't even have headphones. It was just Omar Minaya, like, clearly hot and bothered, and then Adam Rubin clearly hot and bothered. And I was like, Turn the plane around. Yes. I got to go back to Costa Rica.
Oh, it's awesome. Welcome back. That's terrific. I love it. That feeling, whatever you felt, that feeling of like, oh, that was all that year. Like, it was just nonstop. This year has been more, it's just a different thing. This is more just disappointing and it's annoying. But that was just, ugh.
I would say that, I want to see if you can, I'm going to put you on the spot, because I remember a specific moment that year, and I believe we were together in the SNY office when it happened, that I always cite as the, like, rock bottom moment for the Omar Minaya Mets. Do you remember it?
Was when he called Heath Bell Keith Bell?
No. It wasn't Minaya himself involved. It was an on-field moment that season. So that year, there were so part of the problem was not only was that every guy was injured, but it was John Neese. It was the end of their window, right? It was like very clearly coming to the end of the window of Beltran and Delgado and these veteran players that they had and who were now starting to fall apart. And the one exciting young player they had left in their system was John Neese, who we didn't know would turn out to be like more or less an average pitcher. But, you know, at the time you were still kind of excited. At least every 5 days you get, you know, the Mets are terrible. At least every 5 days you get to watch John Neese pitch, see if he's good. And then John Neese, he hurt his hamstring on a play at first base, and they had him throw a practice pitch, and it was a day game. And I remember the setup in our office watching anything, and it was like he's going to throw a practice pitch, and he just collapsed on the mound. And I was like, that's it, it's over. Like, this is, I don't want to watch a single game for the rest of the season.
I know that whole year. I mean, really, that look, we just talked about it for like 10 minutes. I mean, obviously, that was it. This one, it's again, like I said, it's rough and it hasn't, and it's, I don't think it's going anywhere. I think, you know, maybe they can get it together and pull a small winning streak together. But they, at this point, they got to win literally every series they play, and that gets them to around 90 wins. And that still may lose the wild card by 10 games if the Rockies and the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers keep up the rate they're going. I mean, it's just, it is an impossible feat. They have to play better than they did at any point during the previous two seasons, do it for longer, and probably with less players. It's not easy.
I mean, I've looked up the history of, and it's for something, I wrote this all down, and then it's sort of a piece that I have on the back burner, but of, like, complete turnaround teams in the course of a season, like having a horrible first half and still making the playoffs. There are not a lot of teams who have just a below 500 first half and wind up in the playoffs. It's extremely unlikely. You have to be like the 2007 Rockies and just get like completely on fire and win 23 of your last 25 or whatever it was. Otherwise, I mean, they're not going to make the postseason.
And it's still probably, I can't remember the dynamic, it was the Cardinals, but that still takes into account that other teams are not playing well.
Right.
So, like, it's, you know, like Sandy Alderson, the Mets GM, had a quote in one of the papers today, which was something to the effect of, well, we're, you know, we're way behind, but we're only way behind, you know, a couple teams. It's not like we're way behind, you know, eight teams. And it's like, yeah, dude, but you're still way behind. Like, that's the point.
Right. You so need, like, I mean, you're, yeah. They're now behind. They're now behind yeah. the Marlins and the Braves right. in the standings. And you need the Brewers to collapse, the Cubs to not get hot, which they're obviously going to do. Yeah. You need the Rockies, two of the Rockies, Dodgers, and Diamondbacks to collapse as well. It's a long route to the postseason. So the follow-up question to that is it time? Is it? I mean, it's not time yet because it's June, so it's not going to happen because that's just not how the market works. But are they going to sell off? Because they have so many pending free agents after this season. Is
they
it?
Do.
Are they gone?
Yeah, I don't know, but they're not the – I mean, I don't know. You know the landscape – of rosters, I think, better than I do around the league. I mean, who's going bananas for Lucas Duda?
You know, I think there. I mean, you know, and like
Jay
I
Bruce.
I don't know. I have to. You know, you'd have to look at like the specific cases and stuff like that. And like first base happens to be, at least if you look at the National League, like every team that's in the thick of it has a great right. first baseman who's killing the ball right now. So like, yeah, like Lucas Duda isn't going to be a big piece for them. But like, what about the Yankees? Like, right? Like the Yankees yeah. could really use Lucas Duda, and Lucas Duda in Yankee Stadium is going to hit a ton of home runs. So
he'd actually be a nice player there. I mean, it's. There are certain spots where there's fits, but then those teams also have other options and other needs. And yeah. So it's just when I haven't admittedly done a ton of work on this. I'm like, I'm literally just starting. But like the brief look that I've done, it just doesn't – I don't see a big haul coming, right? Like this isn't the Yankees with Chapman a couple years ago where you're going to like redo your farm system.
Well, because you don't have a player yeah. like Chapman. You know,
right,
like
that's what I mean. It's they're good players that might be valuable to some teams, and they may actually be more valuable to the Mets. Like Bruce – may actually be more valuable to the Mets at this point because, one, I think you could argue that he could be re-signed just from the fact that he has held his own in New York and not completely imploded, which is not, you know, you can't say that about a lot of players that mm-hmm. have come here. Like, he's obviously handled it well and doesn't seem to have an issue with Citi Field. And, like, those two things are easy.
Except the defensive aspects of Citi Field.
Correct. Absolutely. But they do have a front office that clearly does not care about defense for all of their – which is a problem, and they should fix that. But besides the point, you know, and then you offer Bruce a qualifying offer. So there's draft picks and stuff. Like, there's actually an argument to keep him at that point, and no one's going to want.
Well, remember, the qualifying offer doesn't come with as good draft picks as it used to.
That's so true. That's true. But what you're getting back in the trade, though, it's still the comparable. I think keeping him in the totality of all that, all those factors, I think you may end up seeing them keep him, which is almost just hard to fathom given where they were 6 months ago with him.
Well, but that's then you're going into. I mean, this is exactly the type of stuff that doesn't appeal to the casual fan we're trying to target here on the For the Win podcast. But you can't go into next season with three corner outfielders again. That's the problem they had this year. You need an actual center fielder. They still don't have one.
That's true. And Granderson will be gone. And I guess the point to this is to make it more appealing. Is I don't think it's as simple as just, are we buyers or sellers? Like, they got to kind of know where this is going and what their plan is. Because this is not a team that's about to rebuild. Like, there is definitely they're going
to
come back.
I mean, but they kind of have to, right? They have, because if you look at, because Duda, so Duda's their first baseman. Lucas Duda's their first baseman. He's a pending free agent. Neil Walker, their second baseman, to hurt right now. He's a pending free agent. Jose Reyes, who is nominally their third baseman or shortstop, is a pending free agent. Granderson, Bruce, like, half of their team is heading for free agency. I don't think you can call it a rebuild because they're still going to be built around the pitching, and mm-hmm. you still going to kind of just hope that the pitching stays healthy and is good, which looks like a longer and longer shot every year now. But I think that, I mean, you kind of got to collect what you can for the guys who are leaving, right?
Agreed. And I'm not saying that they won't let them go. I just don't – ultimately, I'm not sure that they're going to get back much, and you may be able to make the argument that it's better to keep some of these guys, not all of them. I think Duda goes. Like, that makes sense. And like you mentioned, the Yankees are a nice fit. But Granderson's not going anywhere. I mean, you're not getting anything for Curtis Granderson.
Right.
You know, Bruce, I think you may want to keep him. Walker's on the DL. I don't even know when he's going to be back. He severed his hamstring, like, in two. So he may not be back all year for all we know.
Right.
Addison Reed, now they've got some relievers that are going to be appealing.
Right.
And that's going to be where I think, you know, in the past, the Mets were trying to acquire. Now they've got a, they're in a situation where they can, I think, trade these guys. And I think that's maybe where they get a little traction. But to answer your question is I think they'll probably lean towards selling, but I think it's only going to be if it does something that helps them do what you just said, which is like, how can we put ourselves in a position to be able to fill in some of these things next year? Because we still want to win next year. This isn't, you know, we're not going back into another 5-year rebuild.
Right, and that's definitely, I would say there's definitely not going to be, it's not going to be like a blow it all up, but you do kind of blow it all up, right? Like, because you, it's...
Well, it'll get blown up whether they do anything at all. Like you said, a lot of these guys are just going to go. So there's, you know, they're free agents, so they're going to sign contracts elsewhere, and it's just going to happen. So, like, they're going to need to replace a lot of these guys, whether they deal them or not. The question becomes, you know, what do they save financially? What do they get back in terms of prospects? You know, there's a lot of other factors. I mean, and, you know, look, you know, it's a business, and like, they're not going to want to signal necessarily. And there's value to this to signal that, you know, they don't, that they're packing it in. Like, if people, you know, if they can still stay on the edges of it, like, I don't know, maybe the team's call, like, I have no idea how they judge these things, but like, if they do the math and they figure, well, you know, these prospects versus what we can make in a little bit of revenue, like, maybe it makes sense to keep them. And I don't know how that works, but, like, you know, that's how they think. Most teams do. Mm. So, I mean, who knows? I don't know. What I know is that, like I said, they don't have Aroldis Chapman. Like, it's not like they're sitting on the guy that's going to bring back, you know, three or four players that are going to really be meaningful. Like, it's not, they just don't. I wish they did, but they don't.
So let me ask a final question, and I can't believe I'm even asking this, because I'm usually patient with these things, and I usually say, you know, don't blow, like, that's crazy talk, blow it all up or whatever. But which, if it comes to August 2nd and the Mets are still out of the postseason hunt, which infield would you rather see? Would you rather have Duda at first, Neil Walker at second, Asdrubal Cabrera at short, and Jose Reyes at third? Or would you rather have Dom Smith at first, Tito Rivera at second, Amad Rosario at short, and Wilmer Flores at third?
The latter. Obviously. I can't wait to see Rosario and Smith. And I'll even say Cecchini to a certain extent. I don't think he's an all-star by any means. But I think he's right. A good little utility guy.
And I said Rivera as like a stand. Just would you rather see the veterans who are leaving or the young guys who might be factors next year?
Of course you want to see the young player. I mean, especially since these aren't like fill-in prospects. Like, they're guys that I do think they anticipate actually being in the starting lineup next year. So, like, yes, if that's the case, then you have to play them now. I mean, look, I think everybody knows, and I've talked to a couple ex-GMs and a current one in the National League that basically say, like, Sandy messed up. Like, he should have called up Rosario a month ago. Everybody knows it. He probably knows it. And then they missed the boat. They for whatever reason, Super 2, contract reasons, financial, because he wasn't ready. I don't know.
But all missed that's it. Passed now.
I know. And now they're in a position where, like, to bring a kid up in this chaos, in this, you know, this environment, like, it may not even make that much. And they all agree that, like, they'd probably wait. Where they would have done it a month ago, they'd probably wait now. Well, he didn't do it either time, and now is in a position where it's really awkward and strange, and everybody's questioning his motives. And but the point to this being, like, he has to do it. Like, if you're going to start this kid next year and the team is not going to win now, you got to bring him up. There's not a question. And you can make that argument for Smith, and you can make that argument for Cecchini or Rivera and see what they are as an everyday second baseman. And yeah, that's where the Mets are going to be. And I bet you they win more, because I think it's a better infield defense, and I think the pitchers are going to be more comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I don't even know that that's a significantly – I think Duda is underrated by Mets fans especially, and he's a really, really nice hitter. Like, I think that you got to expect Smith would be a downgrade from Duda, at least offensively. But I don't know that that's a worse team than the one they're putting out there, certainly if they're starting Reyes every day.
No, but I'll tell you what, Wilmer Flores' throw has become a lot better when you got Dom Smith at first base. This kid could win a gold glove as a rookie. So, I mean, will make a difference. Like, I can't put my brain in Jacob DeGrom's, but like, or Zach Wheeler, who gets a lot of ground balls. But like, if I'm Zach Wheeler, I would much rather those guys behind me than the bad news bears that they have back there now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. Matt, I hate to end on that bleak note, but thanks so
used
much.
To it.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely, Ted. Thanks. And keep up the great work. And yeah, it was good catching up.
You can check out the For the Win podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud. Rate us, review us, all there. You can check out Matt at MetsBlog.com as always. And of course, check out the book. It's called The New York Mets Fans Bucket List. It's on, you said, MatthewSerone.com/book?
Mets book.
Yeah, yep. Mets book. Not just because the book is for open-ended for whatever next book.
Yeah, there you go.
But it's on Amazon. It's got great reviews. I will tell you for sure if it's good when I get my copy in the mail. But I assume it's very good because everybody on Amazon seems to like it. Matt, have a good one.
You too, Ted.
Peace out.